This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Najoe, and we are talking tomatoes today. And with us is Holly Farrell. She is a horticulturist, an award-winning garden writer, and author of many books. And her latest is The Tomato Grower's Handbook, everything you need to know from seed to harvest and beyond. So many varieties, so many questions. What would you like to know about maximizing your harvest? Do you have tips you'd like to share with us? We'll be part of the conversation. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Holly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well,
go ahead. Well, I think we should kick off by saying you say tomato, I say tomato.
Let's not call the whole thing off.
Absolutely. Let's grow some tomatoes.
As people can tell, you are over in the UK.
Yes, I am.
Yes, you are. But, you know, tomatoes are tomatoes all over the world and a very popular fruit, vegetable. Before people call in and say, hey, a tomato is not a vegetable, it's a fruit. Yeah, we know. But we like to call them a vegetable, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's what's the saying? You know, wisdom or knowledge is knowing that tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad.
That's right. And you do start off your book with that wonderful saying. So I love that. Got a chuckle right away. So I knew what we were going to be in for when we were reading this book. And I do have to say, this is a fun, it's a little book. You know, as Lee, our technical director, was saying, when you said a handbook, I thought it was going to be 500 pages. But it's not. It's this cute little book. Graphics are wonderful. I think it would be a fantastic gift for your gardener, the gardener you have to buy a gift for. The colors are great. It just shouts tomato. It's just a fun book, and it's loaded with information, though, even though it's not 500 pages long. So, how did you get interested in gardening, Holly?
So I was not an outdoorsy kind of girl when I was growing up. I was bookish. I was indoors reading. If I was outdoors, it's because I was reading and I was lying on a rug in the middle of the garden. For me, the love started after university, so after college, when I ended up, through a variety of reasons, being quite unwell for a while and basically was then stuck indoors. I had to be indoors. And when I got well again, I thought, I've just got to get outside. So I took myself off to a chili farm and worked on a chili farm here in the UK on the south coast by the sea. And I worked there for 6 weeks. I worked for my board and I just fell in love with growing and plants and being outside. And so from there, it was off to college to get qualifications and start growing and gardening for people.
It's amazing how one little thing can change your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So why did you decide to do, like I said earlier, you've done quite a few books. Why did you decide it was time for a tomato book?
I think tomatoes are one of those, they're an entry crop, you know, they're a gateway crop for growing other things. So if you haven't grown your own food before, if you haven't grown anything before, tomatoes are a really great thing to start with. Across all of my books, the one thing that I've aimed to do is to inspire people to just get out there and give it a go and start growing. And if you were going to start growing your own food, and maybe you've grown some salad leaves or sprouted some seeds or some strawberries, you know, something simple, but you were willing to give something else a go, you're not going to then go, well, I'm going to plant cabbages or, you know, something complicated that takes a long time to come to harvest and can be beset by quite a few problems. Tomatoes are relatively straightforward to grow. You can eat them straight off the plant. They're delicious. Why not tomatoes?
You're absolutely right. And they certainly taste much better than what you buy in the grocery store.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
The tomatoes in the store, they've been picked at least several days before, probably. They've probably been picked underripe as well, so they last longer on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And they haven't had that chance of being ripened in the sunshine. And there is nothing that can beat a tomato warm in the sun, picked straight from the plant, straight into your mouth. As soon as you pick a tomato, the sugars inside, they start to convert into starch. So they're always going to be sweetest and most delicious straight after you pick them, which is why most of my tomatoes never actually make it to the kitchen.
especially right there in the hot heat of the summer. And it's as you mentioned in your book, it's better for our planet too.
Yeah, absolutely. If you can grow even just a few things that you feed to feed yourself, you're reducing packaging, you're reducing transport miles of things being shipped across the country as well. And it's also the plant itself is sequestering carbon. So the more plants we grow, the better it is.
Absolutely. Well, we do have a call from Mia in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Mia.
Hi, Mia.
Hi, good morning, you guys. Thank you for taking my question. So as you know, I'm based in Milwaukee, and I don't necessarily have a lot of outdoor space to grow things. I'm a beginner planter, if you'll call it that, and have a little herb garden and love to grow basil. And we know tomatoes and basil go really well together. So I'm wondering if there's a specific species, type, and then method of growing tomatoes indoors that you would recommend.
Okay, so you're right, absolutely. Basil and tomatoes go really well together, but they also grow really well together. If you grow your tomatoes with the basil, you're actually going to enhance the flavor of the tomatoes. They've done scientific studies on this. The tomatoes taste better if you grow them with basil. So what you can do is if you've got space for your little herbs, then you can grow your tomatoes upwards, and then they're really going to take up very little space. So the kind of tomatoes you're looking for in the store, if you're going to buy plants or seeds, are called indeterminate or cordon tomatoes, they're sometimes known as well. These are the types that you're going to grow as a single stem straight up like a tree. You need to tie it into a stake so it doesn't flop over. And then basically your tomatoes will grow off that main stem, and they'll be going up, whereas your herbs are still around the base. So you've still got plenty of room.
That's a great idea, Mia. And you'll find plenty of those right now. And this is the weekend to do it. Memorial Day seems to be like and it's Memorial Day this weekend here in the States. And that seems to be like the weekend that everybody in the upper Midwest says, you've got to plant by now because we're not going to get any frost. Whether or not that's true or not, everybody can debate that. But that seems to be the perfect time. And, you know, tomatoes like warm soil. And it's actually kind of cool this weekend. So if you don't get them in until next weekend, which is supposed to be really warm, you should be good. So thanks for that question, Mia. Now, you actually talk about, we call it companion planting. You talk about it as intercropping, where you put different kinds of plants together. Why is that a good idea to do?
Well, first of all, you want to cover the ground, really, because if you're not covering the ground, so if you are growing those tall, thin tomato plants, you're going to have a lot of space around the base of them. Whether you're growing in a vegetable bed or whether you're growing in a pot, you've still got some empty space around that base of the plant. So if you don't plant something, nature's going to plant something for you. Weed seeds are going to come in and they're going to go, oh, excellent, I've got some space, I've got some light, and this pot or this garden is being watered regularly. Perfect, I'll start growing. So if you grow something else, you reduce the work for you in terms of weeding. And so you may as well grow something that you can get a benefit from as well. So basil, like I said, is a really great one, or any other herbs. You might like to grow marigolds, which are a really great companion plant for tomatoes. So especially the Tagetes types. You can grow, obviously, the calendula types of the pot marigolds. Both are brilliant for attracting in pollinators and also things like hoverflies, which are going to be munching on the aphids that might try to get to your tomatoes. But the Tagetes ones are particularly good because from their roots, they secrete chemicals that will deter any soil-borne pests that might want to come along and munch your tomato roots. So it's a win-win.
Absolutely. We love win-wins. So tell us a little bit about the history of the tomato, because it really does have an interesting story behind it.
Yeah, it really does. So they come originally from South America. And I have to say, you guys over in the States were much quicker to pick them up as something that you could eat than we were in Europe and in the UK. So originally, because they're related to plants like deadly nightshade, people thought that they weren't edible. And, well, I'm not going to eat that because it's poisonous. So they were just grown as an ornamental crop. And they're known as, in Italy, for example, as pomodoro, because they were called pomme d'oro, which is the golden apple, the apple of gold, because originally mostly they were yellow rather than red. And so they were grown as these beautiful ornamental crops, which, you know, I think all the waste of all that delicious fruit that they were just staring at. Anyway, eventually, some people thought that they might be an aphrodisiac. So a few,
that's definitely one way to get people to eat them.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So a few people started eating them. And then they realized that those people weren't dying. So more people started eating them. And they were still not quite sure that these fruits were safe to eat. So they would generally get cooked a lot. You know, boiled to death is definitely the phrase that I would use here. So I'm not sure what nutrient value or flavor they had by the end of it, but people did start eating them by about the 1800s. So, like I said, America was much faster to pick up the tomato as something that you could eat and you could then eat raw. So there's a record of Thomas Jefferson growing and eating tomatoes in 1809, but it wasn't until maybe sort of 50 years later that here in the UK, people were actually going, oh, you know what, these are really tasty and we should grow more of them. And then from there, it's just taken off and there's thousands of varieties that we can grow now.
It's amazing. Every year there seems to be more and more varieties, and it's confusing sometimes. We're going to take a little bit of break and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Our guest is Holly Farrell. She's a horticulturist and author of many gardening books. Her latest is called The Tomato Grower's Handbook, Everything You Need to Know from Seed to Harvest and Beyond. What tomato questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. And coming up in the next hour of the show, we'll talk about the beneficial insects that you want to have in your garden. Right now, we're going to take some emails. Poor Nathaniel emailed us. The temperatures where he is got down to the high 20s. And he said that's probably about -5, -2 Celsius for those who do Celsius. And when he woke up this morning, his tomatoes and his peppers were sagging. So he's assuming that they're going to die. But he trimmed away the bad leaves in hopes of maybe encouraging some new growth. He's wondering if there is any recommendation for recovering plants suffering from spring frost, or should he just empty the pots and try again?
Yeah, that's a tough one, whether you cut your losses and just go again. I mean, maybe you could do a half and half approach, you know, select the best ones to keep and then maybe invest in a few more just so that you're sure that you're going to get a harvest. My sympathies.
I know.
We've all been there. We've all made that mistake and put things out too soon or not protected, or, you know, it's really a question of, and this is no comfort now, obviously, really sorry, Nathaniel, but it's really a question of just keeping an eye on the weather all the time once you've planted out. So that you can rush out there with a bit of bubble wrap or horticultural fleece or newspaper or whatever you've got to hand just to keep the worst of the frost off. in terms of recovering them, yeah, I think you're doing the right thing. That sounds, you know, snip off the worst bits, hope for the best. If you can put them somewhere more sheltered, you know, cosset them a bit to help try and help them recover, then that would be great. And yeah, just make sure that they don't get frosted again by, yeah, covering them up overnight. And cross all your fingers and toes.
We're so optimistic as gardeners. It's not going to freeze. I know it's not going to freeze. Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember the Memorial Day rule, Nathaniel. I'm really sorry that happened. It is so frustrating. But yeah, cover them up. I know a lot of people that use the gallon milk containers and even start them in that, and that works pretty well. So there's lots of options out there to try.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can DIY any sorts of containers to put over the top of things, or yeah, you can buy mini tunnels and cloches and all sorts of things while those plants are young. And even as they get older as well, if you grow bush tomatoes, determinate ones that aren't going to get tall like the cordon types, then you can continue to cover them. So because they're low to the ground.
Right.
So that is definitely something to consider if frosts are going to be a problem once your plants have got a bit bigger.
Right. Because once we get into fall, we have to worry about that again. So, yeah.
Yep.
So John emailed, is there a way to store or partially process fresh tomatoes until he has enough to can salsa or other sauces? He says it always seems he does not get enough tomatoes to make a complete batch.
Grow more tomatoes.
There's that.
That's one way to do it. But yeah, so what you can do is you can ripen them all on the whole truss or even the whole plant. So, and this is especially useful, as you say, going into the fall, going into autumn, as we call it. If you think frost is coming and your tomatoes haven't quite ripened yet, sometimes a great way to do that would be to pull up the whole plant, hang it upside down, and then let them ripen on the vine. So that can be a really good way to do that. If you haven't got space to hang the whole plant, then yeah, you can snip off the individual trusses and hang them and ripen them like that. Putting them in a drawer with a ripe banana or a ripe apple again can speed up the ripening so that then you've got lots of tomatoes all at once rather than them coming in dribs and drabs.
Now,
I think that's probably the best way. Try and speed up the ripening rather than storing the ones that are already ripe.
Sure. Now, in the book, you do mention about freezing the tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And you freeze them together. You don't do anything to them other than just freeze them. You don't slice them, dice them, whatever, peel them.
Yeah. And if you are going to make them into a sauce, then you could do that too. You can freeze the ones that are ripe and then wait until you've got enough and then defrost them and then cook them up into one big batch of sauce or ketchup or whatever it is that you want to make, for sure.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for the email, John. We've got Mike in Minocqua who has a question. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, good. I have a small greenhouse, and I use it because of the deer. That's the main thing. I keep things watered, and I always have some tomato plants in pots, big pots, and they leaf. You know, they get a lot of, it's a great looking plant, but the tomatoes are either green by like the end of August, or they just don't grow. I just don't get good fruit. I was wondering if I should be adding fertilizer on a regular basis. You know, I use potting mix, but I don't fertilize it regularly. Should I be fertilizing the plants?
Good question. So the nutrient that's particularly going to encourage your plants to make more fruit is potassium. So you could try giving them a high potassium feed. So there's proprietary ones, things like Tomerite we have in this country. I'm sure you've got similar ones, even a rose feed. But if you look on the back of the label, it will have what's called an NPK ratio. N is nitrogen, P is phosphorus, and K, confusingly, is potassium. And so you want a ratio that's got a high number for the K. So that should encourage them to fruit. The other thing is make sure that you are trimming off side shoots and pinching out the side shoots to make sure that you're concentrating all the plant's energy into ripening those fruits that you've got rather than making more. And you want to be stopping the plant from producing any more trusses when it's already got 4, 5, 6 maximum probably. And then that way the plant's going to concentrate on that rather than making more leaves and more trusses of fruit that will never ripen.
And just trusses, when you say trusses, you mean like the main stem of the tomato?
Yes.
Okay.
So the truss is the bit of the stem that holds all the tomato fruits okay. on it. Yeah. So if you're growing a tall, thin tomato plant, a cordon tomato plant, you've got the main stem coming up the middle, like the trunk of a tree, and then you've got little truss branches coming off that and leaves. And that's all you want. So you don't want any more side shoots growing long out the sides. You would just want that main stem with leaves and trusses, and that's it.
Okay, excellent. Well, good luck with that, Mike. I hope you get more fruit this year. So thanks for the call.
Yeah, good luck, Mike.
So you have separated tomatoes into 4 main groups in your book. Tell us what those 4 main groups are and some of the characteristics of those. I've never seen them done like that, so I think it's a kind of a neat idea.
Okay, so yes, we've got basically different sizes of tomatoes, different shapes of tomatoes, and you would use those potentially for different things as well. So the smallest type of tomato you've got is a cherry tomato, which, you know, does what it says on the tin, is about the size of a cherry. And these are the ones that you're probably just going to eat straight off the plant like I do. Or if they make it to the kitchen, you're going to put them into a salad. Just eat them raw, probably. They're not that great for cooking, unless you want to roast them whole on the vine, which is delicious. But like I said, there's lots of crossover. The next group you've got is a salad tomato. So that's your kind of, that's a standard looking tomato. It's about the size of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a bit smaller
tennis
than a baseball.
But a tennis ball, right?
Yeah. Yeah, about that kind of size. Usually round, nice and round, usually quite nice and red, although you can get different colours. And that's, like it says in the name, it's salad tomato. It's great for slicing into salads. You can put them in your sandwiches, that kind of thing. Again, generally one for eating raw rather than cooking. Then there's the plum tomatoes. So these are the ones that are going to be, if you buy canned tomatoes in the supermarket, these are the ones that are going to be in that can. So the interior of a plum tomato, for starters, obviously, it's more elongated in shape. And the interior has less seedy, innardy, gloopy stuff and more flesh. There's all sorts of technical stuff I could get into here, but basically it's got fewer seeds, more flesh, which means it's going to make a smoother sauce and a less bitter sauce. So that's the one that you'll be going to be chopping up and making your tomato sauces, your ketchups, and all your preserves and things. They're really great with the plum tomatoes. And then finally, the biggest ones are the beefsteak tomatoes. These are, you know, they can be as big as your hand. They can weigh up to 1 pound. They've got that sort of ribbing look over the top. So if you've ever been to France or read novels where women are wandering romantically through French markets and picking up tomatoes to have with crusty bread and olive oil, this is the kind of tomato that you're thinking of. And they are brilliant for slicing, as I said, with a bit of crusty bread and olive oil or lashings of butter. They do also make good sauces as well, because the inside of them is, again, not so much on the seeds and a lot of flesh.
Okay.
There's your four main groups.
Yeah, great. And then there's the heirloom.
Yes.
What's your definition of heirloom? Because, you know, you hear that all over the place, and there never seems to be like one definition.
No, I don't think there is, which is, I mean, once upon a time, we didn't need to say heirloom or heritage tomatoes because everything was what is now defined as a heritage or heirloom. It basically means that it's an old, probably an older variety, and it's open pollinated, and it's generally used in contrast to an F1 variety. So an F1 is one that's been bred for specific traits, like disease resistance, for example, so blight resistance, perhaps. And the thing with F1s is that you can buy a packet of F1 seed and grow your tomatoes. But if you save seeds from those tomatoes that you've grown, they won't necessarily come true next year. Whereas if you save seed from your heirloom or your heritage ones, they're open pollinated and they should come true next year. You'll always get a few rogues, but that's how it works. You take those out and you don't grow them again. And then that way, especially if you're growing seriously in every year, you can actually develop your own strains of a variety that's perfect for your plot. You select the best performers every year.
What are some other reasons to grow heirlooms?
It's all about diversity.
Yeah.
We have to maintain the diversity of our food crops, especially now with climate change. We just don't know what's going to happen. It's everything is so unpredictable. We don't know what varieties are going to do well and what varieties aren't in the future. So if we concentrate, if we put all our eggs in one basket, or all our tomatoes in one basket, and only have a few different varieties, what happens if they then can't cope with the conditions where you are? You're stuck then, and we lose the tomato as a food crop. Whereas if we maintain that diversity by growing as many different strains, both new and old, then it just gives us more options in the future.
We did get another email. Barbara emailed us. She's happy to say that she started 3 different types of tomatoes, cherry beefsteak and an orange variety of some sort, outside in gallon milk jugs for the first time ever, starting seeds, and they are growing wonderfully. She is in Milwaukee, and it's still too cold at night or in general, so she'll wait probably 2 more weeks before transferring. Do you have any tips on what to do when transferring them to her raised bed? Are the garden mesh nets beneficial, and how would pollinators get in?
Okay, so first of all, moving them outside. Do this gradually. Imagine you are the tomato plant. You've had a lovely time, and it's been nice and warm, and you've been given every attention by your lovely gardener. And then if you just then get shoved outside, put into some cold ground and left your own devices in the cold air, it's going to be a bit of a shock, and you're going to take a few days, weeks even, to recover. So let's make it nice and gradual and easy for them. A bit like, you know, sending your kid off to college, you know, they still come back to get their laundry done, right? So, you know, it's doing it gradually. So put them outside during the day only. You know, when it's ready and you're pretty sure there aren't going to be any frosts, put them outside just for the day in a nice sunny spot, and then bring them back in overnight, and do this for about a week. And this just lets their skin, for want of a better word, just harden and toughen up a little bit, so that when you do then plant them out and they're out there all the time, they're ready for it. And then that way they will keep growing nice and smoothly and romp away, and you'll get a really great harvest. So if you want as well, you can leave them out overnight in the pots and maybe cover them with some fleece or newspaper before, you know, do that for a couple of nights before you then plant them out permanently. It's up to you. I tend to skip that bit sometimes. I'll just do the daytimes and then put them straight in the ground. And then they're out there permanently. In terms of pollination, tomatoes are actually self-fertile. So technically, they don't need a pollinator. So they don't need insects to come and buzz around the flowers. But they will be helped by the pollinators. And also having those flowers there with nectar and pollen that the insects can eat is really great for the insects too. So, you know, it's not just about our tomatoes, it's about helping them. Tomatoes don't generally, or at least in my experience here, tend to get afflicted by too many insects that you wouldn't want, pests, basically. So I wouldn't worry too much about putting any mesh around them. And if they do get a bit of aphid or whitefly or something like that, then either you can just sort of nip that bit off, put it in the compost, or you can have faith that some opportunistic insect is going to go, oh, look, there's lunch, and a hoverfly is going to come in, or a ladybird's going to come in. And ladybird larvae can eat thousands of of aphids in their lifetime. So, and that obviously helps them as well. So plant them out slowly and don't worry about the mesh.
There you go. When you're putting them out into that raised bed, do you have any tips on how deep they should be or how far apart they should be, that type of thing?
So actually, you can plant tomatoes a little bit deeper. Usually you would plant so that where the shoot turns into roots is at soil level. That's sort of standard rule for most garden plants. But you can put tomatoes in a little bit deeper, so you can bury a little bit of the stem, maybe half an inch or maximum an inch. And that's going to help them grow nice and sturdily. And then they can also develop more roots off the side of that bit that you've buried, which will obviously then help them take up more nutrients and things. And then in terms of spacing, it depends what type you're growing. So if you're growing cordon tomatoes that go, you know, straight up, they're relatively narrow. But you want to make sure that they've also got plenty of air circulation around them, because if you cram in too many plants close together, that's when you're going to get the humidity around the leaves that can then foster the chance for fungal diseases to take hold. And that's when the dreaded blight can come in. So give them a couple of feet between each plant, at least, and then that will make sure that you've got plenty of air circulation, space for the plants to grow.
Let's talk a little bit about watering tomatoes, because that's a really, really important thing for many reasons. So why don't you give us a little info on that?
Sure. So, yes, obviously, we have to water plants if it doesn't rain, otherwise they will die. Plants need sunshine and they need carbon dioxide from the air. You know, those two are fairly self-explanatory, and they need water to grow. So if we don't give them enough water, they're going to get stressed. And a stressed plant is an unhealthy plant, is a plant that's more likely to get diseases. And it's also not going to produce those delicious tomatoes, which is why you planted it in the first place. However, we can't just be splashing on water whenever we want. So if we are irregular in our watering of tomatoes, especially once they start to fruit, that's when you're going to run the risk of things like the fruit splitting. So if you give them not very much water, the skin of the tomato fruit is nice and tight, and then you give them loads of water and it goes woohoo, and then it pumps loads of water into its tomato fruit and the skin splits as it swells and expands. So keep it regular, keep it nice and even. Generally, if you can, water them first thing in the morning, because then the plant has got all day to take up that water. If you're watering them in the evening, that's when the slugs and snails come out. And if the soil's nice and damp, it means that they've got a nice smooth surface to to slime over. So water them in the morning if you can. And always water the roots, around the roots, and water really thoroughly. So check your soil first, stick your finger in it. Is it nice and moist? If it is, you don't need to water it. If it's dry, water it slowly so that it doesn't just all run off. You know, make sure it's sinking in around where the roots are, and do that really thoroughly every day if you need to, or every other day. It's really, it's down to how, whether you're growing into in a pot or a raised bed or in straight into the ground, how fast that water is going to evaporate. And of course, the weather will be a big factor too.
Yeah.
So
you can't do it on a regular schedule.
You've just got to get out there and be with your plants, be one with your plants, and watch it. And then the final watering tip is, as your fruits start to ripen towards the end of the season, that's when you actually want to tail off your watering, because now is when you want all those sugars to concentrate in your fruits. And if you water them loads, obviously they're going to get more dilute and you're going to get watery tomatoes. So just tail it off slightly, not so that the plants are drooping, but, you know, just start giving them less as the summer comes to an end, and you'll get much sweeter, more delicious tomatoes as a result.
Excellent. Our guest is Holly Farrell. She's a horticulturist and author of many gardening books, and her latest is The Tomato Grower's Handbook, Everything You Need to Know from Seed to Harvest and Beyond. Do you have any questions about growing tomatoes? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up next week, we'll be live from Bayfield in Bloom. And our guests are going to be UW Extension statewide horticulture outreach specialist Bruce Spangenberg, DNR forest health specialist Paul Segun, and co-owner of Bayfield Winery and Blue Ox Cider, Phil Bradish. So we'll have those three gentlemen with Larry, and we always have a wonderful time. So we're looking forward to that. Right now, we're talking tomatoes with Holly Farrell, and we've got a call. Rita in Middleton. Go right ahead, Rita.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this great show. There is nothing like going out to your garden and picking a fresh tomato. My question is, putting eggshells around your plants. I've been collecting eggshells and throwing them around. Can I put too many on? Would that not be good for my tomato?
Hi, Rita. Interesting question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. No, I don't think you could put too many on. I mean, generally, everything in the ecosystem is about balance, right? It's, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Are you putting them on because of slugs and snails or for the nutrient value?
Just for the nutrient value. I save compost, and I put compost in when I plant them. So there are eggshells already in my compost and coffee grounds and all sorts of fruit and vegetable stuff. But yeah, I've just been adding extra eggshells. I just planted them last week, so just wanted to see if I should just back off on it now.
I don't think so. I don't think you need to either way, to be honest. I mean, it sounds like your homemade compost is brilliant, and that's probably got everything in it that your tomatoes are going to need anyway. Why don't you experiment? You know, if you've got more than one tomato plant, keep putting the eggshells around one and not around the other and see which grows better.
Yeah, that's a great idea, Rita. Have fun. speaking of fertilizing, what are your recommendations for fertilizing tomatoes? We talked about it a little bit, but let's expand on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, in general, I don't think you need to fertilize as in terms of buying bottles of fertilizer. You don't need to do that as much as the companies who sell that fertilizer would have you believe. Okay. So if you're planting them in good soil or good compost, then that's going to have a lot of the nutrients that they'll need anyway. And like I said, it's all about balance. If you're planting in a pot, then you will need to give them some extra food and food fertilizer, because the nutrients in that compost will run out by the end of the season. It only lasts about 6 weeks, your pot of compost, the nutrients in that. So after that, you could be giving them some liquid feed. I don't bother with the little plugs of slow release or controlled release fertilizer. I find they never really work. A lot of them have got plastic in them that you're then adding to the soil. So I wouldn't bother with any of those. Go straight to a liquid feed. You can use an organic seaweed feed that you can buy. That's a nice balanced one. That's really great. Well, I'm sure you have an equivalent to the one that we have here. Or you could be making your own. So you could brew up a bucket of nettle tea or comfrey tea, for example, just by steeping them in some water for a few days and then hoiking out the vegetation and using that to water your plants. You could make some molasses feed otherwise. So by using about a pound of molasses in 2 1/3 gallons, thereabouts, you know, it's not exact, don't worry if a bit extra goes in. And that can be really good for tomatoes because that will not only add minerals to the soil, but it will also increase the sweetness and the acidity of your tomato. So you're getting a really great flavor profile. And it will increase the vitamin C content of your tomato as well. So it's going to be even healthier for you.
I have never heard of that. That's a new one on me. That's really interesting. So just molasses, like treacle, like you get out of a jar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Give it a good stir so it's all nice and dissolved and dilute in the water.
Amazing.
And then, and water it on. Don't, you know, not for every watering.
No, do that
maybe once a fortnight or once a week at most.
But give
it a try.
Oh, that's excellent.
Experiment.
Yeah.
Do that on some and not on others. See which come out better.
Yeah, that's half the fun of gardening is experimenting and see what works, especially vegetable gardening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Being curious.
Yeah. So just to kind of go over some of the things we didn't talk about in your book, you do talk about like troubleshooting for some things. You talk about preserving, obviously, propagating, which is fun. Finding, you know, getting the seeds, saving the seeds. And you have a section in the back where you talk about some really cool tomatoes that people probably haven't heard of before. And you suggest they try them. Are there a few favorites that you think that people might want to run out or not run out and find because they might be hard to find, but to look for when they're looking for new ones? Give us a couple of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at this point in the year, it's going to be a little more difficult because you're basically looking at buying plants, not seeds. But there's always next year.
Yep.
So start having a look now for sure. I hate this question, I have to say.
I'm sure people
because there's just so many to choose from that are so delicious.
Well, I always look at the names like I do for wine. I look at the labels. So.
Yeah.
But the blue bayou looks really cool.
Yes. Yeah. And then you can get some of those anthocyanins that you would, you know, get from eating blueberries and things like that.
Right.
But in your tomatoes as well.
Right.
So, I like to grow a variety of different colors and a variety of different shapes and a variety of different types to use for different things. There are some that I would always grow. And that would probably, that list would be Sun Gold, which is a yellow cherry tomato, really delicious and sweet. Yellow Pear, another, it's a cherry tomato, it's a baby pear tomato. So it does look like a very small pear, narrower at the top and bulbous at the base. And that's one of the oldest recorded varieties as well. And that's absolutely delicious. Black cherry, Gardener's Delight. For cooking, probably Rio Grande or San Marzano is the classic Italian variety for the plums to grow for cooking. I really like Ailsa Craig as a salad tomato. It just looks like a child's drawing of a tomato. It's round, it's red, it's everything you could want from a salad tomato. But Tigerella, the stripy one, is really great as well and has a lovely flavour. In the beefsteaks, I do like Marmond, but Black Crème is a really delicious and amazing looking one as well. So really dark skin and then a red flesh on the inside. So when you slice it open, if you're growing tomatoes to put on Instagram, that's definitely one to grow.
Well, of course we are.
Principe Borghese is a great one for being able to store by hanging the plant upside down, like I was talking about earlier. There's so many.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I try to grow a few favorites and then at least experiment with at least 1, 2, 3, 10 new ones each year.
And a good place to find some that you might not have thought about is just going to a farmer's market and see if you like them, find out what they are and try them for next year. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So we're getting near the end here, but I just wonder if you could talk about this green tomato jam that you've got. You've got a few recipes in here, and this one sounds really interesting. So tell us about that one.
Yeah, it came out of everybody usually uses their green tomatoes, you know, end of the season. You've had to harvest them all because the frosts are coming. They're definitely not going to ripen, even if you put them in a drawer with a banana for weeks. They're going to stay green. So what do you do with them? Because you don't want to throw them away. You've put all that effort into growing them. So the standard thing is usually chutney, which is delicious, and I'm not knocking it. But I wanted to do something different, and I like making jams. And so because they're quite firm and zingy and they've got that, it's hard to describe the taste as anything but green. You know, it's that sort of herbaceous-y, fresh taste. And so it goes so well with lemons. So basically, yeah, the recipe is you cook up your tomatoes, your green tomatoes, with lemons, and it makes a jam. And it's delicious on toast. If you like lemon curd or anything else, or marmalades, you know, those kind of less sweet things to spread on your jam. It is still sweet, but it's on the zesty and sharp end of a jam scale, I suppose. So yeah, definitely want to give it a try.
Yeah, it sounds really good. It's just the tomatoes, lemons, and a little bit of sugar. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. So again, the name of the book is The Tomato Grower's Handbook, Everything You Need to Know from Seed to Harvest and Beyond. Again, it's a smaller book. It fits in your hand really nice. You can take it out to your garden, but, you know, maybe not, because you don't want to get it dirty. So, we've got like a minute left, but people have been growing tomatoes upside down and sideways in the last few years. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, they look great in the photos. Yeah. I mean, plants, they want to grow up upright, you know, so eventually they're going to start curling around and they're going to start growing up again. So, I mean, you can do it as a novelty. And I always say, experiment, be curious. If it works for you, then great. But I think if you are stuck for space, try growing instead the little tabletop varieties, the dwarf varieties of tomatoes, where you can grow them the normal way up, green side up, and they can sit on your table and you can pick your own dinner straight off the plant.
Perfect. Perfect. And remember to keep them watered, right?
Yes.
What are the other ones that we really need to keep in mind?
Make sure
tomatoes.
They've got enough sunshine and enough warmth.
Enough warmth.
Sunshine,
warmth, and water, and they will come together for a fantastic fruit, vegetable, whatever you want to call it, for your summer enjoyment.
Yes. Good luck and enjoy, everybody.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Holly. We really appreciate you coming, spending some time with us to talk about tomatoes.
I have very much enjoyed talking about tomatoes.
Wonderful. Thank you. We've been talking with Holly Farrell. She's a horticulturist and author. Her latest book is called The Tomato Grower's Handbook, Everything You Need to Know from Seed to Harvest and Beyond. Stay with us, because after the news, we're going to talk with PJ Leash about insects. Well, this is probably not a news flash, but there are lots of beneficial bugs in our gardens, and they can play a range of different roles. So on Garden Talk today, we're going to take a look at few of those and how they work for you. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad you could join us today. PJ Leash is with us. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the University of Wisconsin. Do you have questions about insects in your garden? Maybe how to attract all those beneficial ones? Well, give us a call. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Thanks so much for being with us today, PJ.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jill.
And usually you're here Wednesday, but once in a while we get you to come over on a Friday because, you know, our garden folk probably appreciate bugs a little bit more than the people on Wednesday do. But, you know, bugs get a bad rap.
They do. I mean, and in my mind, it's really the situation of that proverbial squeaky wheel getting the attention.
True.
It's the ones that are nibbling on our plants or being a nuisance around our house. Those are ones that I get a lot of my questions about. But numerically speaking, the vast majority of insect species around the globe are beneficial in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of damage does it do when we're trying to get rid of those ones that do get the squeaky wheel? And, you know, because then we're getting rid of so many of the good ones.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that I really have to be cognizant of. And when folks contact me at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, maybe to identify an insect pest and discuss what to do about it, part of my job is to really lay out kind of the buffet of management options and talk about the pros and cons, the strengths and weaknesses. You know, sometimes folks can spray an insecticide to manage a pest, but if it's a broad spectrum product, that could have potential harm on all sorts of things. Maybe there are some kind of lower impact treatments that won't harm as many things, or they're only active for a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. That can be an improvement. Sometimes we have some very specific types of treatments. And over time, you know, compared to 50, 100 years ago, there were some bad pesticides. I mean, DDT, but even before that, there were various salts of lead and arsenic and things we just generally know of are not going to be good to be out there for insects and humans and other animals too. And sometimes we have these very specific products. Maybe they only work against one specific group of insects, like caterpillars, and that's going to be an improvement over something that could harm bees and beetles and all these other things. And in general, with pest management, not so much for home gardens, but we're starting to see some specific treatments that involve what we call RNAi. These are kind of molecular-type treatments that are specific basically to one insect.
Wow.
And so that is really exciting in my mind, that you could disrupt physiological processes within one insect species. And so over time, we're getting more and more selective. Rather than a sledgehammer, it's kind of a fine scalpel. So hopefully that trend will certainly continue. And then there's also in that kind of buffet of options, and it varies from insect to insect, but also person to person. I'm often asking questions like, how much free time do you have? Do you work from home, or are you maybe retired? That's very different than someone who works at 9 to 5, or maybe you got young kids and you're tired. and it's hard to go out there and handpick Japanese beetles for an hour or something like that. But there are plenty of non-chemical approaches. These could be kind of physical, mechanical. Sometimes we're using barriers of one kind or another to physically block access to the plants. Mm-hmm. This could be mesh netting or row covers and things like that. If the pest can't get to the plants, they can't damage them. Sometimes we can make decisions prior to planting, like choosing specific varieties or cultivars or types of plants that are maybe less prone to having issues with insects or diseases for that matter. So there's, again, this whole buffet of options. I found over time some folks want that quick solution, one and done. You spray once, it corrects the issue for the entire summer. And those kind of things, usually they're not present. And if they are, they tend to have more side effects on beneficials.
Sure. Do we tend to overreact? Sometimes we see two bugs and all of a sudden our crop is going to be gone or what have you.
I do certainly see that happen. Now, intuitively, I feel we all have this kind of general understanding that there's going to be kind of a critical number or threshold. And what I'm getting at is if you're a farmer and you see one grasshopper in your field, you're going to shrug your shoulders and you've got lots of other stuff to work on. If you went out into your farm field and you saw a billion grasshoppers, that's very different.
Right.
And so there's this idea from agricultural crops, the idea of thresholds. And folks do a lot of research to figure out, like, what's the population of these insects that actually makes a difference? When should you intervene as a farmer or grower so that you don't have economic losses? And if they're under that, it's really not going to be worth your time, effort, or money to necessarily do anything. Mm-hmm. For home gardens, it's a little bit different because each person, we have different preferences. And some folks are just going to tolerate little to no damage. And other folks will say, I've got plenty. The bugs can have some.
Right.
And I still have plenty of cabbage and tomatoes and things like that.
Some gardeners will plant specifically, okay, here's the stuff for the bugs, and this is the stuff for me. So,
yeah, and I mean, sometimes you can use that to your advantage. There are certain types of crops that insects maybe have a strong preference for. Mm-hmm. And when I've taught on campus, one example I've used along these lines is if you put out a bunch of different types of pizzas, you got pepperoni and supreme and, you know, Hawaiian pizza, people are going to pick and choose what they want. And same kind of things can happen with insects. And if you know specifically they like a certain type of squash, like Hubbard squash, for example, can be very attractive to certain insects. And if you plant that and it helps kind of draw the pests over there, and you can kind of have those sacrificial, if you will,
sure,
then that can help kind of protect the rest of your plants in the garden, a different variety.
For sure. Well, we've got a couple of callers, so let's go to Gary in Milwaukee first. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, hello. I have grapevines in my yard, and every year these vines develop galls on the leaves. And I have read that these galls are caused by aphids, and it sounds like they work their way up from the roots through the plant, and they should be able to be killed by a systemic. But the only systemic I can find that'll do the job are neonicotinoids. I don't want to use neonics. And I'm just wondering if PJ has any other, maybe a mechanical barrier. He just mentioned a mesh netting. But again, I thought these things worked their way up from the bottom of the plant. I'm not sure if that would work. But I'm wondering if PJ has any idea beyond neonics to kill these aphids.
Yeah. And Gary, in this case, are you still getting plenty of grapes on the plants?
The vines are only 3 years old. I was surprised I got enough last year to make some enough jelly to, you know, get my family. I expect to get more this year. But I'm still getting, I'm getting grapes. And the grapes are nice.
Okay. I mean, one thought in a case like this, because the bumps, those little galls, funny looking bumps on the leaves, they are indeed caused by an aphid-like insect we call a phylloxerin. They're teeny tiny little things. So using a physical barrier, I have not personally heard of any great success with that. They are challenging because depending on the life stage of the insect, they're either associated with the leaves, and those are noticeable, or the roots. There's actually differences in terms of the types of grapes that are planted. Some just are much more prone to injury from those. I will say, though, in many cases, the insects, those galls may be very noticeable, but the actual impacts for you might be minimal. And that's why I asked about, are you still getting grapes and are they good? If you're still getting grapes, you might not necessarily need to do anything about this. It may be more of a cosmetic thing. And with galls in general, there's galls on all sorts of types of plants out there. In a lot of cases, it leans more on the cosmetic or aesthetic side of things than a threat to plant health.
Okay. Good luck with the rest of those, with the grapes, Gary. I mean, I have grapevines growing up near my cabin in the UP. I don't do anything with them. You can barely find them because they're in the weeds. And I get tons of grapes every year. It's amazing what neglect will do.
Yeah. And actually, along those lines, there's a really interesting story with those insects. They had, at one point in history, made it over to Europe and France. The French grapevines that were there at the time were getting decimated by them. And they had to figure out a solution. It was an American entomologist here who figured out the rootstock on American grapes was much more resistant to these. And
makes
so
sense.
They actually took those and started grafting the French grapes onto American rootstock, and it basically saved the French wine industry. So there was an American entomologist who got a big French award by figuring this out.
Mm-hmm. I like it. I like it. Vivian had called, and unfortunately she had she dropped off, but she was wondering if birds eat monarchs.
They do a little bit. Of course, monarchs, as larvae, they feed on milkweeds, mm-hmm. and they can incorporate some of those milkweed toxins into their body. So not a whole lot of things eat monarchs. There are specific insects that will attack them. There are certain types of birds, but it's not a broad kind of across the board that all birds will eat them. There's a couple specific types that I have heard of. I have seen pictures from places like down in Mexico, for example. So my answer to that is for birds, it's going to be pretty minimal, but in a few cases, there's some. Other birds, if they were to try and eat a monarch, I suspect they will probably end up basically puking because of it, because of those chemical defenses.
And they've learned over the years.
Yeah, birds are smart. They learn very, very quickly that this black and orange thing, you eat it, you don't feel well. And they're going to learn to avoid that.
Right. And isn't there another butterfly that copies a monarch because of that? Right?
Yeah, so there's another butterfly we have in the state called the viceroy, which also has a somewhat similar black and orange coloration. Mm-hmm. If you've never seen them before, you might mistake them for one another. And one thought behind it is it could potentially be a form of mimicry. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of that other species being black and orange, things might not eat it.
Yeah, interesting. Gotta love nature. Lori in River Falls emailed us to ask, what is the best way to control cutworms in the garden? They're targeting her peppers and radishes, and she's worried about the green bead seedlings that will be coming up soon.
Okay. Yeah, so cutworms, there's actually an entire family of cutworms, the family Noctuidae, and this group includes cutworms and armyworms. It's a very, very big family of insects. And we have a lot of species in this group. Some of them are migratory, meaning they don't overwinter here. The adults fly up, and some of these are agriculturally important for field crops, black cutworm and things like that. We also have some kind of local or resident species that can overwinter here in our climates. For those migratory species, their numbers can vary from year to year. I tell folks it's kind of a roll of the dice. If you saw them last year, doesn't necessarily mean you'll get clobbered by them again this year, because if the wind is blowing more to the east or we don't get those jet streams bringing them up here, each year can be a little bit different. For some of those local ones, you know, if you do have a local population, a couple things come to mind. In a lot of cases with cutworms, the way I think of it is if you have a big, hungry cutworm caterpillar and you have a small plant, that's a bad combination, because they tend to just cut it down at the base of the stem, and then you go out and you see it lying there on the ground, which, of course, is frustrating. That actually happened in our own backyard garden just this week. So, but for these cutworms, they have a lifespan as larvae that usually lasts about a couple of weeks. And so one thing you could do is keep an eye on things. And if you happen to see them and catch them in the act and you say, okay, we've got big cutworm caterpillars, they're an inch and a half, I would suspect if you waited another week and a half, those would have pupated.
Oh.
They're not feeding as pupae.
Sure.
They're going to transform to the adult stage. They won't be feeding on plants then or, you know, causing damage. And so you might be able to time it and avoid some of that damage. I always recommend to folks going out and doing some scouting. And a lot of times cutworms like to be active after dark. And so if you're not seeing them during the day, head out after dark. And it makes sense. If you're a big, juicy caterpillar and you're out at high noon, a bird's probably going to eat you and get a good meal out of it. But if you go out after dark with a flashlight, you might see them in the act. Now, if you have a small garden, you could consider hand-picking, squishing them, whatnot. Another trick you could try, because those and many other insects will like to hide during the daytime, if you have an old shingle or a board you could put on the ground, that can give them a hiding spot. And so for small gardens, if you can go out there once a day, flip over that board or shingle and, you know, squish those or pick them up and collect them, that could be a consideration. For a larger garden, that might not be as feasible, or if you're working long hours every day, that might not be as feasible. If they seem to be causing problems, you know, cutting those stems, one consideration might be to do a little bit of spraying, but you don't necessarily have to spray the whole plant. You could treat just the base of the stems where they like to chew. That's going to reduce your overall amount of spraying. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're spraying just a little bit at the base of the stem, the chances for drift, the droplets moving, mm-hmm. and risk to beneficial insects in the area is going to be greatly reduced.
Sure. More control. That makes a lot of sense.
And one other thing about that, if you go to the garden center, you can often buy products that contain the ingredient Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT. That is a specific type of bacterium with insecticidal properties. And there's the Kurstaki strain, and that's important to get that. It works against caterpillars and only caterpillars, and that could be an option. You have to keep in mind with products like that and others, it works best against small caterpillars. And if they're big, they're much, much harder to control.
Okay, you caught me during a cough. When you see that, PJ, you're supposed to continue to cough, to talk.
Noted.
Anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about, you know, like pollinators, because it's, of course, hot topic for everybody and obviously for you. What are some of the ones that we really want to attract? I mean, we all know bees, but we don't know what kind of bees, because there's not just one kind of bee, obviously. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that we should try to be bringing into our gardens.
Yeah. From the standpoint of pollination, it's somewhere between about 85 to 90-ish% of angiosperms, those are flowering plants around the world, mm-hmm. have some sort of animal pollinator, and most animals, numerically speaking, are insects. So insects play a crucial role, and I've seen estimates, it's roughly about one out of every three bites of food is due to insect pollination.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, yeah, the produce section at the grocery store would be very different if we didn't have mm-hmm. insects. So insect pollinators, crucially important. Obviously, as you mentioned, bees, but in Wisconsin, we have between 400 and 500 species of bees. So pretty much everyone is aware of honeybee, bumblebees. We actually have close to two dozen different species that have been documented here. Yeah, there's variation in size and color patterns. And then pretty much the rest of all our other bees are these solitary creatures. They live alone. And in many cases, a given species might be active for a brief window of time, 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
In spring or the period of the year when they're active, and then they're gone and done until next year. And so you almost blink and you can miss them. So there's all these different bee species out there. Some of them can be very specialized in terms of what they do. And for gardens, a great example of that would be something we call the squash bee. These specialize on pumpkins and squash and cucurbits. They'll actually nest in the ground, maybe a foot or so in the soil near those plants. And so if you're growing those year after year, you'll probably have a population of these. This is something that in my own yard and garden, I like to show my kids, because the male squash bees, when they're done doing their business, they'll often just go into the squash flowers and nap in there. And so I've gone with my kids and opened up flowers and say, look, you can see the little bee taking a nap in there. So there are bees that are pollinators. Most folks don't realize it, but a lot of flies can be excellent pollinators. Beetles are the most abundant, most diverse group of animals on the planet. Numerically speaking, I suspect we probably have more species of beetle pollinators in the state than bees, because there's going to be thousands of beetle species in the state. There are other things that can be pollinators too. Wasps often get a bad rap, but most of our wasps are going to be beneficial predators or parasites. And so one suggestion I often have for folks, if you, in the simplest terms, want to attract more of these to your yard and garden, diversify the plants that you have and increase the number and type of flowering plants. Because a lot of these insects that might be beneficial predators or parasites, they need fuel, carbohydrates, Gatorade, if you will, so they can go about their business, and they'll come to flowers, do a little bit of pollination too. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a lot of benefits from some of those insects.
So we also, besides the variety, we want them to be blooming at different times of the year too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We have some insects, certain bees, that are basically done for the year already. They were out in April for a couple weeks. We won't see them till next April. but there's this pattern of emergence throughout the growing season. Some are early, some are mid, some are late. I tell folks, if you have, you know, 20 different plants that all bloom in your yard in July, that's awesome for the insects that are there in July. What about the ones in March, April? What about the ones in September, even October? So to have that temporal blooming pattern, that's important to think about too.
That's wonderful to know, because most of us don't realize that those little insects are only there for a little while. So has that been affected? I know that our seasons have changed because of climate change. Are the insects adapting to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, from a certain point of view, yes. When you think about it, I mean, we obviously have climate change going on and a lot of variation from year to year. Some years, in layman's term, we have kind of an early spring. Other years, it's a late spring and so on. The insects don't have a calendar like we do. They go more by heat. And so one thing entomologists and scientists can use is something called growing degree days, which is basically a more mathematical way to look at the accumulation of heat rather than going by calendar.
Sure.
And so if things warm up early, we intuitively know this, but insects will pop out earlier. If we have snow flying until May 15th, it's just going to slow down the emergence of insects. So in that regard, you know, insects are adapting to a certain extent with their behavior and emergence patterns.
Okay. Let's see, one more thing that we've got about a minute left. So what a good question for you. What are decomposers?
Decomposers. So technically, if you're talking to an ecologist, you might refer to those as detritivores. But think of them as basically recyclers.
Okay.
These could be things like you could think of dung beetles as decomposers. They're breaking down dung specifically. But there are all sorts of detritivores or decomposers that are breaking down animal remains. You know, if there's roadkill deer, something like that, flies show up often the first thing. But there's a huge, long list of insects and related arthropods. These are things like springtails and millipedes, roly-polies and stuff like that, that are feeding on plant matter that's fallen on the ground, is decomposing. So they are helping break this down, return those nutrients to the soil and the ecosystem around them. And that's really critical in terms of what we call an ecosystem service or a benefit that insects provide to the ecosystem.
And sign of a healthy soil?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Great. All right, again, beneficial insects. PJ, thanks so much for coming over. It's a short time, but we really appreciate it. PJ Leash is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you have a question, you can always contact him by
email, or what I'd suggest, just do a Google search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you'll find my website.
Absolutely. Pops up right away. So thanks again, PJ. We'll really appreciate it. Stay with us, because we're going to be talking about some of those hazards that you may have for your pet in your garden. Are not the only hazard for pets in our gardens. So today we're going to talk about some of the other problems that we as gardeners need to be aware of. I'm Jill Nadeau. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. And with us is Dr. Sam Bilko. She is a UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and emergency and critical care clinician at UW Veterinary Care. What questions do you have for her about the safety of your pets in your garden? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Bilko, thank you so much for spending a little time today with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You bet. So you had done an article and I saw it and I'm like, oh my gosh, this will be perfect for Garden Talk, because occasionally we have people that call up and say, you know, is this hazardous? And most of the time our guests have no clue because, you know, we're gardeners, not veterinarians. So do you get many problems, many pets coming in with problems because of gardens?
I would say that most of it is ingestion of like mulch or compost or things that might taste good or be new and interesting to dogs as springtime rolls around. Mm-hmm. Less so with like fertilizers and things that are spread on the lawn, but definitely a lot of those woody-based products that dogs like to eat.
They just like to chew on stuff.
They sure do.
Yeah. Is it cats so much or is it mostly dogs?
Cats tend to be a little bit more discriminatory in what they are eating.
They do, don't
although,
they?
Yeah.
Almost too much sometimes. So let's look at that list. The number one on your list was compost. Now, that's a really important thing for gardeners to have. So what is it about compost that's a problem?
Yeah, so compost tends to create a really warm, moist environment that's good for bacteria and certain molds to grow. Mm-hmm. So we can see certain microorganisms that cause tremors, muscle activity, seizure-like activity in dogs when ingested. Okay. We call them tremorgenic mycotoxins. And that can definitely be a reason for your dog to come to the veterinarian because we need to make sure to stop that muscle activity and those seizures and cool the pet down.
How long is it going to take between them eating that and that those kind of symptoms to appear?
It depends on how much they eat, but it can be pretty rapid.
Okay. So that would be pretty easy to pinpoint then? Because I would imagine that's really difficult. You can't ask the dog, obviously, so that the person bringing them in can tell you, I saw them eating at the compost pile.
Yeah, absolutely. They just tend to have these very characteristic spasms that owners will pick up on.
Okay.
And then when you don't recognize that as a normal behavior and you bring your dog to the vet, the veterinarian will know to ask, hey, is there compost out recently that you've been turning? And then you'll be like, yeah, of course. And I've seen the dog over there. So then we can kind of connect the dots.
Okay. And so they should be seen right away.
They should. Yeah.
Okay. Good to know. What's usually your... What do you do to help them?
We give them medication to stop the tremors. If they're having seizures, we give them anti-seizure medications. Mm-hmm. And your body can get really hot and overheat from all that muscle activity. Mm-hmm. So we have to cool them down as well, just to make sure there's no damage to organs.
Okay. So your recommendation is just keep the pet out of that area. Generally,
yeah. As much as possible, keep them away from the compost pile.
Okay, so fence.
Yes.
a fence. So next on your list is mulch. Mm-hmm. We spread that every year, generally every couple of years. So what's going on with that?
So mostly that is a obstructive type hazard for the GI tract. So, for example, my dog loves when we spread the mulch. She says, oh, so many new sticks that you brought me. And then she starts to chew on it. But I know that if she's going to eat so much, her GI tract is not made to break that down. And so it can cause impactions and obstructions that might potentially require surgery to remove. Mm. And so something that seems like just chewing on a stick, if you eat enough of it, can result in a hefty vet bill. So we definitely want to prevent that from happening. The mulch itself is not so much toxic, except for like cocoa mulches sometimes have chocolate-type toxins in them, and so can cause some of those chocolate toxicity signs. But other than that, it's more of a impaction concern.
Okay. Now, there was probably maybe 10 years ago where there was all kinds of stuff going around about the cocoa mulch, and you can't have it, and it's, you know, it's so bad. And so, how bad is it, and should we not use it at all, or... what is the actual truth behind the cocoa mulch?
I think I would have to look at the percentage of cocoa within the product to be able to say for sure what types of clinical signs a dog would experience. And again, it would depend on the amount ingested and the size of the dog.
Okay.
But the typical signs of methyl xanthine toxicity are going to range from GI upset, kind of the low end of the toxic range, all the way through abnormal neurologic activity like seizures or heart arrhythmias. At really high ingestions. Mm-hmm. So those would be the concerns. And then obviously the impaction from it just being mulch on top of that.
And so, and we didn't really talk about that, but the signs of impaction, basically... constipation, I'm assuming.
Yeah, profuse vomiting, usually persistent. The dogs often don't want to eat, which in dogs that are eating mulch is generally a pretty big sign because they want to eat anything and everything. A lot of times they can't keep water down when they're trying to drink as well. So I would be concerned if I saw any of those things.
Sure. And that, again, get them to the vet right away.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Victoria in Millidor emailed us. She wants to know if you use Roundup on some weeds and wait until it dries or even a day or two later, is it okay to let your cats out on the sprayed areas? And what if they eat the sprayed plants after this time?
So most chemicals and pesticides exist in really dilute concentrations when we ultimately spray them on the plant. Mm-hmm. In the bottle, it might be a little bit more concentrated, so we definitely wouldn't want any pets getting directly into the bottle. But once they are diluted, sprayed on your yard or on your plants, they tend to dissipate into the environment pretty quickly. So I would say keeping the animals off of that grass area, off of the plants for a few days at least. For every particular product, it's going to be a little bit different. So definitely looking at that package insert and making sure that you're following any health and safety recommendations according to the label as well is important.
So that has to do with like all the sides. So the herbicides, the fungicides, the pesticides, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And I know a lot of people are concerned about the sprays on grasses. I mean, even if they're the neighbor's grass is being sprayed. What kind of concerns should you have for your pets about maybe drift or, you know, them running over to that yard and coming back?
Again, it has to do with the time and the dilution of the product. So once it's applied to a lawn, it tends to be fairly dilute. So we don't see a whole lot of toxicity mm-hmm. unless the animal gets into the original concentrated source. But we do recommend, just to be completely safe, to keep pets off of that area of the lawn, away from the neighbor's lawn. If you are concerned about any area bordering the neighbor's lawn that's been sprayed, maybe just temporarily not allowing the dog access to that area just for a few days after the application. Mm-hmm. And then after a few days have passed, it's no longer a risk.
Okay. And then there's fertilizers, another one that we have a lot of in the garden area in our landscape. What should we know about those?
Kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. Fertilizers, again, are more toxic in the concentrated forms, so just straight from the bag, which not a lot of dogs are eating straight from the bag, of course.
Hopefully not. Yeah,
they can also have really high concentrations of certain, electrolytes and substances that we don't necessarily want the dog ingesting in high quantities, like phosphorus, for example, mm-hmm. potassium, those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Then there are the products that we use to kill other pests. People can go kind of crazy on that too, whether it be mice or other kinds of rodents or what have you. Those are very, very dangerous, obviously.
Absolutely, yeah. So this would be probably my biggest concern is these types of pesticides. And rodents are a big one, of course, but snail baits, molluscicides, those toxins can be very potent in dogs and cats, and they can often cause fatal seizures. And so we really want to make sure to keep any amounts of those pesticides away from our pets.
Mm-hmm. And what about if we do have a mouse or rat or whatever that has eaten it and dies, and our pet then eats that animal, what happens then?
That's a great question. You can ingest enough animal or mice, shall we say, that has died from ingesting that toxin. If you eat enough mice, then the cat, I would presume, rather than a dog, usually gets intoxicated as well. So there's a little bit of dilution that happens when the mouse eats the toxin, then it's within the entire body of the mouse, and so it's a little bit less concentrated. Mm-hmm. But then the cat eats multiple mice, and eventually they will accumulate enough that they suffer signs too.
Okay, and what would those signs be?
Again, usually seizures, but there are certain mice chemicals that are going to cause like mineralization of the kidneys, the calcium-based products.
Wow.
They can also cause bleeding. So we have ones that prevent blood from clotting too. Those can be equally dangerous.
Nasty. So when an animal comes in like that, you must not know. So there's got to be a lot of tests that you have to run.
Absolutely. We have several blood tests that we can do to look for each of the most common kinds of mm-hmm. pesticides. And then there are usually hints on the physical exam and the history that can lead us down one path or another. Mm-hmm. There are treatments. So for example, for the bleeding type of rodenticide, there are treatments for the calcium-based ones. There are treatments. is not really a good treatment for bromethylene-based products, which are the most common types of rodenticides that we're seeing. So it's really important to keep those away. And even if you're putting them in those like little black boxes that people will put outside with the compound in it and thinking mm-hmm. that it keeps it away from the dog or cat, animals are sneaky and they can chew open the capsule or they can get in there anyway. And so we really need to be careful.
Yeah. So don't use poison.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Ideally, yeah.
Just don't use poison. Our guest today is Dr. Sam Bilko. She is a UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and emergency and critical care clinician at UW Veterinary Care. What questions do you have for her about the safety of your pets in your garden? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Join us again on Monday and Memorial Day. We'll be listening to a couple of interviews that Larry did last year. First, we'll look at the Vietnam War era through its music. And then we'll continue exploring the power of music with the author of the book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as a Medicine. And yes, that song is now stuck in your head. I'm very sorry. I've been singing it all day and not very well. But anyway, right now we are talking about your pets in your garden with a veterinarian from the vet school here, Dr. Sam Bilko. And we've got Don in Two Rivers that has a question. Go right ahead, Don.
Hi. I was wondering about ant baits, which we place around buildings, try to keep the ants out. And if a dog would ingest one of those, I know some have borax in them. I don't know the ingredients of all of them.
Yeah, Don, that's a great question. So definitely ant baits can also be toxic to pets. If you're ever concerned that an animal has gotten into it, because as you said, the active ingredient can vary between different types of pesticides, it's really important to take a picture of the packaging or bring the packaging with you to the veterinary office and or use it when you're calling a poison hotline. So there are animal poison hotlines, same as there are for people. And then we can determine using all the data available to us and the specific active ingredient and concentration if we need to be worried about that particular bait.
Okay, great. Thank you for the question, Don. And we do want to let you know that there's two poison pet lines or poison lines for pets, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
The ASPCA Poison Control Center, which is 888-426-4435, or the Pet Poison Helpline, which is 855-764-7661. Two numbers that you probably should have on your phone these days. You know, you could probably look them up fairly quickly, but two great ones.
Absolutely.
To have nearby, somewhere where you can get at really quickly. Things happen fast, just like with children. Right?
Absolutely. And it's important to use a pet-specific hotline because what is toxic to dogs and cats is a little bit different than what's toxic to people sometimes. And so to get that veterinary-specific data, you want to call one of those two numbers.
Absolutely. Jean in Mosini emailed us. She brought home a bag of Milorganite to fertilize some of her areas in her yard. She did not know that dogs are very attracted to it, and her miniature schnauzer chewed a hole in the bag and ate some of it. She still cannot get the spot out of the carpet from where he threw up black Milorganite, and she didn't have to take him to the vet, but she never bought it again. To this day, the smell of it just makes her sick.
Oh, no. Well, I hope that little guy is okay.
Yeah, it sounds like it, but that's the one thing, too, is that you never know what's going to be attracted to certain dogs. But the size of the dog makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, a lot of toxins are dose dependent. Mm-hmm. And so a smaller dog can eat the same amount as a larger dog, and that smaller dog might experience more profound effects than the larger dog.
Yeah. And I mean, we started talking about some of the things in your yard, but there's, of course, always plants, and a great deal of them are poisonous if you eat them to people and pets. How can we tell?
Yeah, so there's a lot of plants out there with a lot of variable levels of toxicity. The vast majority just have chemical type irritants in them that can cause GI upsets, or a little bit of mucous membrane. So that's like the inside of your mouth irritation. And so sometimes we'll see some hypersalivation, vomiting, diarrhea. Those are just natural protective compounds that plants have within them. But then there are additional plants like lilies, for example, which are definitely growing right now and that are highly, highly toxic to cats, for example, and can cause kidney failure.
Wow. And most of the time, the pets ignore those, but not always. So
not always, yeah.
Keep an eye on them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now there's one something that was just, oh, I know. Speaking of which, pets seem to eat grass a lot, or sometimes, you know, and I don't know why. Why do they eat it, number one, and should we be concerned about it other than they tend to walk inside and then throw up on your rug?
What a great point and a great question. I wish I knew the answer. Okay. I don't know if anybody does. I think I've heard a lot people say, oh, animals eat grass when they're nauseated and they want to make themselves vomit. I've had a lot of pets over the years and they all just like to eat grass. Yeah. I don't know if it's the water content or being outside or what exactly it is, but it does tend to come up on the carpet a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I go to the dog park and, you know, I get my dog, Seamus, gets back in the car and has to throw up. And it's, I don't know how many of my little dog beds I've had to throw out because once it's thrown up on, you can't get it out. It just keeps on smelling.
So. Oh, boy.
Yeah, he's a sweetie. Perry and Oconto, go right ahead.
Yes, I want to ask the doctor if she sees any of these plants that would be more like in a prairie or something, like different grass awns and like Canadian rye and things like that that can actually either be inhaled or puncture into the skin. Do you see that in your at the university hospital at all?
Yeah, Perry, that's a fantastic point. We definitely see grass awns, little plant seeds. Sometimes they're called foxtails. They can kind of wheedle their way into any soft tissue surface of the dog. So you pointed out that they can be inhaled and then they end up in the lungs. They can make their way through skin and get embedded in muscle. I've seen them in virtually every organ system of a dog. And because they're so tiny, they tend to take a long time to find. And all the while, they're causing a lot of irritation and starting an infection. So these dogs will often come in with more vague signs, lethargy, appetite is waning a little bit. Sometimes they have a waxing, waning fever. If it's been inhaled, maybe a little bit of breathing change. But if you're noticing any kind of more prolonged abnormalities in your dog's behavior and you know they've been exposed, maybe they're a hunting dog, maybe they run around in the prairie, it's probably worth getting checked out.
Definitely. That's a really good question. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, there's always something that's poking me. So I'm assuming there's something poking the dog.
Yeah,
too.
They're sharper than you'd imagine.
Yeah, for sure. A listener emailed us and to ask how concerned should they be about the many toads that live in their garden and yard. They live along the Apple River, so there are many, and their dog is a big hunter.
Oh man, so the types of toads that are toxic are called bufo toads. We don't have those here in Wisconsin. It's more of a southern thing.
Okay.
Their skin can have cardiac type toxins in it, so it can cause arrhythmias in those dogs, as well as hypersalivation and agitation. Here, again, we don't have those toads, and so we probably won't see those effects, although your dog might have a little bit of stomach upset if it's eating too many.
I used to have a cat that liked to catch the frogs in my pond.
They're hunters.
They're hunters. Oh my gosh. We were talking about mushrooms the other day on the show. And should we worry about the mushrooms that are growing in our yards?
Yeah, that's another great point. So there are several types of toxic mushrooms. Some of them can cause more of those muscle tremors like we talked about with the molds, maybe some salivation, diarrhea, wide eyes. Those definitely need to be treated but are not necessarily fatal. And then there are the types of mushrooms that cause a fatal liver failure. So usually these are the Amanita mushrooms that tend to grow in wetter environments, in pine forest type environments. So I am not a fungus expert by any means, but there are resources that you can use online and groups that will identify mushrooms in the field if your dog has ingested them and or bring some with you to your veterinary office.
Okay. And then, of course, the biggie I'm sure you're getting right now, ticks.
Yes, absolutely.
What should we do in our yard to try to take the ticks down, and what can we do, obviously, for our pets so that they're not quite as dangerous for them?
Yeah, because ticks are going to be carried by other animals like deer and rabbits and coming into the yard. There's not always a great way to keep these guys out unless you have a pretty good fence. So using a monthly flea tick product on your dog is going to be the best way. And they also make these for cats as well if you have an indoor-outdoor cat. And so really keeping up with that, especially during the warm months, anytime that the temperature is above freezing, we expect that there is going to be tick exposure. So I would say that's the best way.
Okay. If you have other questions too, more appropriately to ticks and whatnot, we do have our one of our vets that come in and take your other pet questions. That's coming up on Tuesday, so you can save those too. Since we're talking about the garden today, one of the things I've noticed is that dogs in particular, they like to dig, and you never know what they're going to be doing. What are some of the problems that can be caused by digging in the garden, breaking nails, and what are some of the other things that we should be concerned about that way?
Yeah, so I guess there's the physical trauma that you mentioned. If they do injure their skin in any way, break any toenails, usually those can be cleaned fairly readily. Broken toenails can be removed. Perhaps the injury is just cleaned out a little bit, maybe bandaged. But there are actually, again, certain types of microorganisms, specifically something called blastomycosis that we have in this area, which is a fungus that can be inhaled into the dog and go into other organ systems and cause some really significant problems. So again, that spore is dug out of the soil usually and then inhaled. So we want to make sure that we are paying attention again to those more chronic signs that I mentioned with the grass awns, the same things we tend to see with blasto.
Okay. Now, people can get that too, though.
Yes.
Right. I think we talked about that not too long ago on the show, too. That's a scary one.
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult disease.
And that tends to be more up north than it is in northern Wisconsin than it is down here, right?
Yes. Okay. It is more up north. However, I have seen people with potted plants that come back with them or certain bags of dirt that come back with them that then their dogs are exposed, and we assume that's how they got it because the dog doesn't necessarily have a travel history. I tend to not let my dogs be digging in the woods too much. The other association is usually with bat guano. If there's any exposure of the soil to that in particular, they can get it that way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Denise and Madison, you've got to go right ahead with your question.
Hi. Dogs, cats ingesting things that are toxic to them and then passing it to humans is my question. If the owner goes to clean up diarrhea or whatever is making the dog or cat sick, is there a danger of transmission to the pet owner in, cleaning up what made the dog sick?
Okay, great. Thank you, Denise.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So I would say that with a toxin in particular, it's usually not transmitted via the vomitus or the feces. With infectious diseases, sometimes we can see the infectious organism coming out in the feces, for example. There are specific things that are transmitted from dogs to people, and usually that route involves some kind of ingestion or aerosolization. So as long as you're taking proper precautions, washing your hands and making sure the stuff is away from your face, you shouldn't need to worry about that. With toxins in particular, I would worry even less.
Obviously we want to make sure we clean up after our pets. Can that cause a problem as far as diseases for the dogs themselves or people if we don't do a good job of cleaning up after them in the yard?
They can potentially reinfect themselves if there are infectious diseases that are causing the diarrhea. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, some viruses or protozoa might be able to live in the environment in the feces until they're picked up.
Okay.
So we do usually try to pick things up pretty regularly, I hope, just to make sure that, one, the yard is clean for our enjoyment, yes. And two, to make sure the dogs can't get back into it.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Dr. Bilko. We really appreciate you coming in and sharing your expertise with us and our fellow gardeners.
Thank you so much.
You bet. We've been speaking with Dr. Sam Bilko. She is a UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and emergency and critical care clinician at UW Veterinary Care. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller today. I want to thank our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Pattenaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Thank you for joining us and enjoy your weekend.